Welcome back
to Behind the Crime.
I'm Rebecca Wood.
And I'm Ella Calora.
And we're your hosts. Like we said in the previous episode in the intro, we're going to be referring to this as the July episode a lot throughout it and might say something about our August episode coming out in a month. Like we said in the other one, that's not a thing. Just pretend we're not saying that. Ignore it.
We're not crazy. We know it's October.
Possibly November when this comes out. November. Hard to say.
We're busy, guys. So sorry about that.
But we're back to our every other week schedule now that we're back at school, so don't fear.
Yes. Never fear. We will give you your
Never fear, Behind crime. The Crime is here.
Oh. All right, let's get into it.
This is our 13th episode.
Which I just have to say, I only realized that it was our 13th episode today, and I got very sad because I think we should have done something to do with the number 13, because obviously everyone knows that, like, number 13 has a lot of, like, bad vibes connected to it, and there are, like, cases where, like, the number 13 comes into play, but I only realized it today, so I'm a little bit upset about that.
I was already done researching, so I was not doing any more.
I'm a little upset about it.
My mom was born on a Friday the 13th. Fun fact.
I love your mom.
Oh. Me too.
Anyway.
She's going to love listening to that.
Hello, Becky's mom.
She says hello.
Oh, does she?
But this is our July episode. Mm-hmm. And we picked a summer camp theme for the episode.
Yeah. So I'm going first. And
I'm ready.
I think one of, like, the things about, like, cases that, like, happened at summer camps, I think one of, like, the creepiest things about them is that you have a huge, like, group of children in one area. And, like, in a lot of cases, mm-hmm. like, if it only happened to one or, like, a handful of children, it's just, like, the thought always crosses my mind that there was, like, a bunch of other kids there. Like, why those kids? And, like, also the thought that, like, it could have been more.
It could have been all of them, really. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So.
See, I never went to, like, away to a camp in the summer.
You didn't?
My parents are teachers, so they were always off in the summer. So why were they going to spend money to send us away when, you know, we would go camping, we would do stuff on our own? What's funny is one summer, my cousins, they used to always go to summer camp because their parents worked and they didn't want to go anymore. So they came to our house every day and we had, like, activities planned and we would go, like, sightseeing. Mm-hmm. So, like, we were their camp, except they went home at night. Mm-hmm. But it was fun.
Mm. I went to 3 different summer camps in my childhood.
Oh, look at her go.
I know. I was went for a week. One was in...
I watched Camp Rock. Does that count?
I don't think so. One Camp was Rock. In South Carolina.
Oh.
One was in Michigan. And one was in upstate New York.
How have you never told me that?
I don't know. They were fun. You just go to summer camp to get away from your family, I guess. Oh. I would also get, like, scholarships to go, so, like, my parents didn't always have to pay for it. I also work at a summer camp. I should mention that.
Yeah, you should.
I've never actually gone as a camper to the summer camp that I work at, but I do work at a summer camp and retreat center. I'm not going to name drop it, but... I've been working there for almost... This will be my 7th summer, and I think that's crazy. I don't work directly with the kids because... I would not want to be responsible for them, but I work in our little dining room and our little snack shop, and it's fun. We've never had any incidences, and even if we did, I probably shouldn't say it, but we haven't, so.
It's because you're there. They don't want to mess with you.
Definitely. Also, our lake is like a pond, but you know what? If anyone from my job listens to this, I'm sorry, guys. It's not a lake. It's not a lake. It's a pond. Anyway, I'm going first this week, and my case is the case of Bobby Bissip. This took place in Colorado. Bobby is the only son of Joseph Bissip, and his mom's name is Connie. Bobby was born almost completely deaf, and he did have a hearing aid, but it didn't really... do much for him, but despite that, he was a very smiley, happy young boy. And one thing worth noting is that because he was deaf, no one, he couldn't, like, speak as well. So the only people who could really fully understand him were his parents.
Yeah.
And he would use a lot of, like, signing, and people to communicate with him would do a lot of signing, and he could read lips. But that is definitely something worth noting in this case.
Yeah.
So, yeah, his father was in the Air Force, and he was stationed at a nearby base, and his mom was a stay-at-home mom, I'm assuming mostly for Bobby's sake. So then getting into the camp, I'm going to explain kind of how the land around the camp worked. So It's Mount Meeker's Barren. It's a summit to the west of the Colorado Highway 7. It's between Allen's Park and Estes Park. At 13,911 feet, Cabin Creek is up there, and also St. Catherine of Siena Chapel is up there, and around this is where the Catholic Church camp is. It's called Camp St. Milo. The chapel is referred to Chapel on the Rock because it is literally, like, on the side of a mountain. And then the land around it, it's always described as, like, very beautiful, like, a lot of trees. It's referred to as God's country. So, beginning in 1915, the Reverend Joseph Bosetti began taking members of the Cathedral High School choir and altar boys on camping trips up Mount Meeker. And by 1934, some buildings had been built and Camp St. Milo was created. The chapel was built a few years later because it was a religious-based camp. And then by 1950, the camp was very popular for the Colorado area. A lot of people would send their boys for a week in the summer. Anyway, so the camp would open just for 6 weeks each summer, starting in late June into August. They would have boys ages 9 to 16 come for a week at a time. They would arrive Sunday afternoon and then leave by the next Sunday morning. They would have about 75 to 90 boys around that number there at a time. So it's not that big of a camp.
Yeah.
At least to me. Like, all the camps that I've been to, I feel like it was more than that. So not,
from my extensive knowledge from watching Camp Rock, that seems like a pretty small camp. No, I'm so serious. Like, that is pretty small. Because I knew people who went to camp, so I know a little bit.
Yeah. I just like how you know,
I was being
called upon your Disney Camp Rock knowledge.
I watched.
Very reliable source, Rebecca Wood.
Demi Lovato? Yes, she is. And the Jonas Brothers.
Can't forget them. So, Friday, August 15th, 1958, it was the last week of camp that summer. And Bobby Bissup had been to this camp before. This was actually his second visit that year. And he had been three times the previous summer. So his parents really trusted this camp.
Yeah.
Bobby knew everyone there and knew the land, was very comfortable there. By 5 p.m. that night on August 15th, 1958, it had rained a little bit and the temperature had dropped to the mid-60s. Bobby had been out fishing. And this is the first point where facts get a little muddled. Some accounts say that Bobby was by himself, and others say that he was with a group of boys. So whichever it was, a counselor named Terry Cowan went to get Bobby for dinner. I have a quote from him. He said, "I pointed to my watch at 6 p.m. to remind him it was nearly time for supper." He then nodded that he understood. And then either the two of them were heading back up to dinner and Terry turned around at one point and Bobby was gone, or there were a bunch of other boys with them and Terry was headed up with the group of boys, and then once they got there, they were doing a head count and Bobby wasn't accounted for.
Yeah, because it would be easier to miss him if there were other people there.
Yeah, so like, oh, because what was published in the newspaper was that Bobby was by himself, but then people were like, well, Terry just turned around and he was gone. And then people were like, well, there were other boys there with him, so that could have made more sense how he got lost or how he went, you know, someone took him, whatever happened.
He was gone.
Yeah. So right away, a search went out for Bobby and nothing came out. The next day, his parents arrived, and within days, the search grew to 500 people.
Oh, wow.
Joe Bishop, Bobby's father, a bunch of Air Force officers from the camp that he was stationed at came up and started helping to look. Mm-hmm. They had this is very random. So a California man even came out with his two bloodhounds to help look. They got an Indian tracker to come, and they had skin divers. The camp leaders destroyed some beaver dams that were creating a couple of the swimming holes.
Oh.
And they wound up draining some 10-foot deep swimming holes in case he had drowned, but nothing came up. On the third day, police started getting reports of a boy fitting the description of Bobby near Estes Park. So if you remember me explaining how the land works, Estes Park is pretty close by.
Mm-hmm.
So immediately people went there to start searching. And at this point, they really thought that Bobby had run off. Even his parents were thinking that Bobby had just run off.
Yeah, sometimes it's just too hard to imagine that it could be something else, you know?
Mm-hmm. So with that in mind, the Estes Park Trail paid for thousands of leaflets containing a message for Bobby from his parents to be dropped over the entire forest.
Oh, wow.
The leaflets simply read, "Mother and father love you. We need you. Mother is sick. She needs you at home. We love you."
That's interesting.
I think it's so sad.
Yeah. Was she, like, when they said she's sick, do they mean, like, sick from worry?
Well, sick from worry. Like, his mom was very distressed. Like,
I could imagine.
She wasn't eating. They even had a doctor assigned to her because she wasn't eating, and they were worried that she was going to actually, like, become very ill.
Yeah.
So then, just a little while later, like, that same day, just a few hours later, a man called the police saying his son looks just like Bobby and they were on vacation in the area. Now, his son looked just like Bobby down to the hearing aid. Like, what are the chances that his son even was deaf too?
Yeah.
And they were vacationing in the area. So it wasn't Bobby. The police checked it out. So that was a dead end.
That's just such a weird coincidence.
Right? Some more muddled facts were some people said that his fishing stuff was found on a hillside right by the camp, mm-hmm. but some people say that it was found a half mile away from the camp. Just very, very different stories.
Yeah.
So eventually the search was stopped, and they had a few people stay at the camp in case Bobby returned, because this was the last week the camp was open.
Mm-hmm.
But they had a few people stay just in case.
That's good.
Yeah. They were actually very thorough about the search.
Yeah, and like the leaflets, mm-hmm. the fact that they paid for them and they didn't try and make it come out of the parents' pocket.
Yeah. So then, almost a year later, in 1959, the camp opened for its 1959 season on Sunday, June 28th. a counselor, Neil Hewitt, was back for his fourth season as a camp counselor.
Mm-hmm.
5 days into the first week they were open, Hewitt and two other counselors led a group of boys west from the camp along Cabin Creek. They crossed into the Rocky Mountain National Park and climbed up eastern facing Mount Meeker. And they were around 11,000 feet in elevation, and they were, like, right above the camp. Like, they could look down and see the camp. While they were up there, Hewitt caught a glimpse of a piece of clothing.
Oh, I knew that was where it was going.
That led to this discovery of a bone.
Mm.
Now, here's the interesting part that didn't come out for a while after this case was actually, like, closed.
Yeah.
The camp didn't call authorities for 3 days.
When they saw the bone?
When they found the bone.
Why? Why would you do that?
Never known. So when they did call authorities, a doctor looked at the bone and said it was from a young boy. So then they assumed it was Bobby. The Park Service organized a formal search of the area, and by the end of the day, more bones and 20 pieces of clothing from shirts, pants, shoes, a red cap, and a Zenith hearing aid battery were all found. So at the time, his parents were actually in Pittsburgh visiting relatives, so they drove back.
Yeah.
And the cause of death at the time was probably from exhaustion and exposure to the outside. His parents did bury him a few days later.
Mm-hmm.
And after that, there was no police investigation. People really just thought that
he ran away.
He ran off, or he just got lost and just ran out of food, or it was too cold.
But if that's the case, they would have found him with how many people they had out. You know what I mean? Like, I just don't think that, like, they would have found him if he was alive and he just got lost. The other thing that stood out to me was the amount of manpower they had out looking for him. Mm-hmm. And then a year later, suddenly they magically see him from atop a mountain. Like, that's just so weird to me.
Yeah. So for decades, no one questioned it. Not even his parents questioned it. But then in recent years, two counselors who were at the camp at the time have been branded serial child sex abusers.
Oh.
Neil Hewitt, who, if you remember, was the one who found Bobby's remains, actually admitted to sexually abusing boys.
And probably Bobby as well.
And at this time, this is decades later, new stories start coming out about the day that Bobby went missing.
Mm-hmm.
Neil Hewitt claimed that at the time he was running the snack bar at the camp, and Bobby wanted to buy candy, and Hewitt said, "No, you've had enough sugar," and Bobby got mad and took off. And that was Hewitt's reasoning for why Bobby ran away.
But why would that not have come out the first time if you had nothing to do with it?
He never said that to any authorities or press until literally decades later. So then Richard Heister, who was 11 at the time and who was the nephew of the man who ran the camp, years later was interviewed and recalled that he believes on the 15th, the day that Bobby went missing, a boy came running past him, and he was really angry and even, like, pushed in to Richard, and now he believes that that was Bobby. So people started speculating, like, why Bobby was so angry and why he was running away. The National Park Service did...
Can you remind me how old he was again at this time?
Bobby?
Yeah.
He was 10.
10. Okay.
The National Park Service Investigative Services branch has opened a new investigation, but a lot of witnesses or suspects, if they have any possible suspects, have passed away already. Another really weird thing that has come out recently that I couldn't find a lot of information about. Supposedly, the skull of Bobby was found in the camp director's basement.
Oh.
I could not find anything that could confirm or deny that. But that was also something that was, in quotation marks, found recently. But people also speculate that either Harold Robert White, who had at least 70 victims, like children,
that he
assaulted, or Neil Hewitt, probably Neil Hewitt, because he's the one that found Bobby, who had at least 9 victims. People speculate that one of them was trying to hurt Bobby and either did kill him, or that's what scared Bobby. And Bobby did run away because he was afraid of one of them. But people do believe now that there was some sort of foul play.
Yeah, there had to be. I mean, and the story about the candy, that's why I asked how old he was. By 10 years old, you're not running away over candy. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? You're like, maybe if you were 7 or 8, but when you're 10 years old, that's not why he ran away.
A lot of the facts are very muddled.
Yeah.
And I mean, Bobby's parents are dead, so there isn't anyone who is passionate. I don't want to say that, like, investigators who are reopening this case aren't passionate
they
about it.
They don't have, like, but the push no from one, the parents.
There's no one really in Bobby's corner. And also, any witnesses or suspects are either dead now or at the time they were really young.
Yeah. And even if they weren't really young, it's hard to remember so long ago, because the littlest thing, if they remembered it then or thought of it then, could have been helpful, but they don't remember that now.
The other very unfortunate thing is, well, the camp closing isn't unfortunate. It closed in the early 1980s and converted to a retreat center, which has now been closed. The unfortunate things, there was a fire in 2011 that destroyed its main building and a lot of the other ones. And then 2 years later, there was a flood that just devastated the entire land. So the only thing that's standing today is the chapel and a few other buildings.
Mm-hmm.
So any other evidence that they thought that they would be able to find was either in one of the buildings that burned down, or, you know, if they thought that they could find something by digging, there was a flood, so chances are it's all gone.
Yeah, that's the problem. If they had just treated it as an investigation that involved foul play from the beginning, they so likely would have found who did it or
but no what one, happened. No one, everyone thought that he did run away.
Yeah, but also especially back then, the idea that people are predators to children, it's not really as prominent as we now know today. Now we all, you know, grew up on Stranger Danger, but Bobby didn't grow up on Stranger Danger like we did, you know? So my case happened in 1986, also in the West, which I thought was interesting when you said that they were both Western. I also wanted to say that when I was researching, violent crimes are actually more common in the summer months.
Oh, I believe
Like, statistically, it has to do with the longer days, people are out, alcohol. So people, more people are out in the house, you know, out of the house.
Well, I was going to say, and, like, people are off from work, and, like you said,
they're off from work, on vacation.
They're drunk. And a lot of people, when people go on vacation, a lot of people have this attitude that's like, this needs to be perfect and I need to have everything just the way I want it. And that can turn into a lot of aggression if something doesn't go their way.
Yeah. So I just wanted to point that out because I hadn't really thought about it before, but it makes sense. And that's something, you know, to be very cautious of, especially if you are on vacation, you're drinking, whatever. So my case is Jacob Wideman, who killed Eric Kane. I'm going to talk about background of pretty much both of them growing up, but I'm going to start with Jacob Wideman just because there's more information out there about him. He was born to John Edgar Wideman, which might be a familiar name because he is a well-known writer. and his mother was Judith Goldman, and he was born in 1970. Later, his parents did divorce, but this was after the murder occurred. So John Edgar Wideman is a well-known writer and is known for his experimental writing styles and has been a professor at Brown since 2004. So he grew up a generally good life because of his father's status and professional achievement. They weren't struggling financially, so there was nothing to really, there was nothing super obvious that he had a bad childhood or anything. So he had two siblings and was the middle child. His siblings are both very, very successful now. His brother is a writer and business executive, and his sister is a lawyer and an executive for the National Basketball Association and played for the Women's National Basketball Association as well, which I just thought was interesting that his life could have turned out so, so differently if he didn't do this, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So in August of 1986, he took an unexpected turn with his life while he was at summer camp. And to give a little bit of background, this was talked about a lot in all the sources I read. John Edgar Wideman, he grew up in Pittsburgh in a very, very poor family in a generally not very good area. And he fought very hard to get out of that. He's very adamant about that. But his brother, Robert, did not make it out of that neighborhood. And he ended up participating in a robbery that resulted in the murder of Nicola Morena, and got arrested for second-degree murder and was sentenced to life in prison. So Jacob is not the first in the family to be a murderer, which I just felt like was important to note.
Yeah.
So Eric Kane was from Long Island and was very, very popular in school, had very high grades, and basically he had a lot of potential, like Jacob Wideman actually did as well. So they were both from similar social and financial statuses. There wasn't really like rivalry or anything like that. But I'm going to get into the camp. They met each other at the camp when they were both 16, and it was actually owned by Jacob Wideman's grandmother, Judith Goldman. So his maternal grandmother owned the camp, and it was in New York State. And throughout some of the camp, Eric Kane and Jacob Wideman were roommates. The camp didn't really take place on the grounds of the camp. They basically took tours of national parks in the West. So I guess they were like, oh, we're taking kids from the East and, you know, letting them travel out West.
Oh.
Yeah, so one of the tours they took at Yellowstone, while they were there, Jacob bought a hunting knife. Now, I'm sure you can all see where it's going, but I'll get to that in a minute. August 13th, 1986, all the campers spent the night at a hotel, and Jacob and Eric were roommates that night, and they were supposed to see the Grand Canyon in the morning.
Mm-hmm.
The hotel they stayed in was University Inn in Flagstaff, Arizona. Eric fell asleep first, and that night Jacob decided to kill him. He used the hunting knife he purchased and stabbed Eric in the chest twice, seemingly for no reason. He then stole the car that the camp was using to travel and stole $3,000 worth of traveler's checks and headed back home towards the East Coast. And Eric's body was discovered the next morning, and the fact that Jacob was missing was obviously suspicious, and he had just bought a knife and he was killed, you know, in a stabbing. So immediately they were suspicious.
They were 16?
16. Both of them were 16, yeah.
That's what I thought.
Mm-hmm. So he got home a week later, and his parents immediately brought him back to Arizona so he could turn himself in, which was good on their part.
Yeah.
Two witnesses, I guess other campers, they said that the entire week Jacob was compulsively sharpening his knife.
Hmm.
Which was very...
That's just chilling. Icky.
Yeah, yeah, chilling. So he was released on bail, and they went back to the East Coast, but his parents put him into a few different psychiatric hospitals.
Mm-hmm.
So they were doing the right things, I guess. Like, they weren't just like, okay, you can just wander around and do whatever. Because this whole time, he was not saying why he did it.
Yeah.
He either didn't know why he did it, or he truly did it for no reason. I also wanted to note that while he was in one of the psychiatric hospitals, he was accused of assaulting another patient, but nothing came of that. No charges were made, but I did think that was important to note.
Yeah.
I'm going to read his confession. It says, I murdered Eric Kane. It was not premeditated. It was the result of a lot of different emotions. I had just woken up. It was 1 a.m. I didn't know what I was doing. I wasn't thinking straight. I was restless. I put on my clothes and I saw the knife and I saw Eric and I picked up the knife and I stabbed him 2 times. I've had a really tough year and he was the target of a lot of my emotions. I'm very sorry for what I did. I should be given a chance to live and make something of my life. I don't want the death sentence applied. They played that at his trial or read that at his trial. That's just such a professional sounding confession, like very rehearsed sounding, which it likely was with his parents on the way there.
Mm-hmm.
Anyways, he accepted a plea deal and was sentenced to life in prison with the possibility of parole after 25 years. Eric Kane's family, not obviously, but they very much wanted the death sentence for him. But he, once again, he was a minor at the time. So he was, you know, he was charged as a minor, not as an adult, even though he technically could have been. In some cases, they will charge 16-year-olds as adults, but... While he was in prison, he married a psychologist that worked in the prison named Marta DeSoto, who had 2 kids. Mm-hmm. And she testified on his behalf during some of his parole hearings, saying that she was willing to have him move into her home with her kids.
No.
So after 30 years in prison, and I believe it was 7 parole hearings, he was released, not on parole, but on house arrest. And this was in 2016. So even though Jacob was a minor when he committed the crime, he killed someone the same age as him, they still decided that he's not allowed to be around children because he killed a child, meaning he couldn't live with his wife, DeSoto. And her ex-husband actually had a lot to do with that. Like, he altered the custody agreement to make sure that he wasn't allowed within 5 miles of the house. So... On July 18th, 2017, about a year later, a warrant was issued for Jacob's arrest, and he was taken back into custody for violating his terms. It's very unclear what the terms that he violated were. It's possible, some places I saw said he went within 5 miles of DeSoto's home, which was not allowed.
Yeah.
And Eric Kane's parents, they actually hired a private investigator, and... His GPS tracker that he had was public information, so they could also track him. And either them or their private investigator were the ones who were pushing for him to get arrested again, and then he did. His attorney claimed that the violations were made up, but he's still in prison today. They haven't backed down on that. Eric's parents said that they would do anything to keep him out of society, and Louise Kane, who's his mother, basically said that she believes Jacob is a sociopath. There was a quote, she said, anyone who can kill someone in cold blood has no emotion, something like that. I don't have it written, but, you know, she was like, if he was capable of doing that, what else is he capable of? To a lot of people, including Kane's parents, they felt that Jacob and his family were not remorseful about it. His father went on to actually write about it a bit, and from the quotes that I read in my articles, he didn't really seem to be remorseful, a lot of people feel. In one of the writings, it actually seemed like John Weidman blamed Eric for the fact that he lost his son, even though Eric was the victim.
See, that's just...
Yeah. A lot of the articles I read were called, like, 2 sons lost, and it's like... But
I did, yeah.
It's like, yeah, they were lost, but it's not, it's the fault of one of them, not of both of them. Because he was sleeping.
Yeah.
And from everything I saw, they got along just fine at the camp. Otherwise, I doubt they would have been roommates. And for a while, they would not speak about it at all. When they were asked by the press, they said nothing. But then he would write things about it. And then his... older brother actually did go on a podcast and talked about it, but I didn't listen to all of it because it was a lot of episodes and I did not have time. But yeah, that was only, I think, last year maybe. And so they spent over 30 years not talking about it to anyone. Some other stuff that I wanted to mention was Jacob confessed to the murder of Eric and another murder of a woman in Wyoming the year before in 1985. But then later came back and recanted it and said he, like, that didn't actually happen. He didn't actually kill someone else.
Why would he confess to it then?
Right? And, like, I don't even think he was a suspect in it. I think he just said it. Nothing ever came of the second confession. Either there wasn't enough evidence to connect him to the woman he claimed he murdered, or maybe there wasn't a woman at all that, you know what I mean? He just made it up completely.
Hmm.
Or there just wasn't enough evidence for it. According to some sources, Jacob had a lot more violent of a past than the family has tried to portray. Some allege that he attempted to kill another boy in October of the same year. He had a history of fighting and stealing. And allegedly, I only saw this in one source, but some people think that he was molesting his younger sister as well. But I don't think the sister has ever said anything about that.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know where that came from, but it is still important to note. None of it's proven, but it was all in written statements from Kane's family that they submitted to the court. So I'm assuming they found this information through their private investigator, and for parole hearings, they would submit it to them.
Yeah.
Oh, I skipped something. Eric's parents, they had said they would do anything to keep him out of society because they felt like he would do it again, no matter what. So that was kind of why they were so adamant about submitting things. Well, if I did, then fine. Anyways, the Kane family felt that Eric was not given justice and that he should have gotten the death penalty.
Mm-hmm.
You know, a life for a life is kind of what they were thinking. And they also said they have no doubt that he will kill again if ever released on parole. So even on when he was released on house arrest, they were not trusting of that. One other thing that I found was very interesting. Jacob's basketball coach spoke about the kind of relationship in the family. And according to him, part of the problem within the family was that the family revolved around the older brother, Daniel. One time, his coach told a story about a game where Daniel was benched, but Jacob was a starter. And after the game, their father went to the coach to complain about it.
Mm.
Because, you know, he was older, I guess. I don't know. That's just so weird. Like, it's one thing to complain that he's benched, but it's another thing to say, well, why is my other one starting?
Yeah.
And one last thing that I wanted to say was the brother of Eric, he blamed John Weidman, so the father. He said that John had a bad attitude and always tried to make things go his way when he was at the camp. His brother was also a camper, so he had experience with John Edgar Weidman.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess since his wife's mother owned the camp, he kind of thought he owned the camp.
Yeah, probably.
But he's still in jail today.
That's good.
He is technically probably still eligible for parole, but I don't know if that's changed because he was accused of violating his terms of the house arrest that he switched to.
Mm-hmm.
But there are a lot of, like, movements going on that his family is running to get him out. So they are fighting to get him out, but I don't.
Let's hope that doesn't happen.
Yeah, especially if all those other things are true, that he did attempt to kill someone else and he did murder a woman.
Mm-hmm.
He was assaulting his sister. And that incident in the one hospital where he was accused of assaulting another patient.
Yeah, well,
that, I think, kind of wraps it up. That's really all we had. Just a reminder to stay safe this summer.
Yep.
Be conscious if you have kids, if you're sending them to a summer camp. I'm not saying it's more common at summer camps or anything like that.
But do your research.
Do your research on where you're sending your kids. Just make sure that it is a really safe environment.
Mm-hmm.
And just stay in contact with them as well.
Yeah.
Yeah, just stay safe in these summer months because violent crime is at a high.
Mm-hmm.
And we will see you in a month.
Yeah.
It feels weird saying a month instead of 2 weeks.
I know.
We're sorry.
Don't
worry. We're doing our best.
We'll be back to 2 weeks in no time, which is weird to say because we're recording this and we're not even out of school
yet.
Yeah,
we still have
one
more week.
It's not even May yet.
And then finals week.
But yeah, thanks for listening.
I know you were about to say watching.
I wasn't.
I don't know.
I said listening.
I know what you said.
thank you guys for listening, and follow us on Instagram at behind_the_crime.
You all need to know that she shoved her hand in my face so that I wouldn't say it.
I'm gonna mute your mic.
No.
Thanks so much for listening.
Bye.
Bye.